And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey. 724-283-2525. It's Butler County's only live call-in talk show. It's your turn. Weekdays from 1230 to 2 on 680 AM WISR and worldwide on the internet at WISR680.com. It's your turn. 724-283-2525. And now, it's your turn with Dave Mullarkey.
Good afternoon once again, everyone. Welcome. Nice to have you with us. Friday edition of It's Your Turn. A little gray and gloomy out there. It has been all day. I don't think the sun's been out at all today. And we may not see much of Old Zol through the entire weekend. Not a whole lot of rain so far today, and maybe not this afternoon. We'll see. Could bubble up. Look at yesterday, you know. It wasn't supposed to rain in the morning, and all of a sudden it just opened up on us. So we'll keep an eye on the radar for you. Looks like the best chance of heavy downpours, though, might be Saturday night and Sunday with the remnants of Tropical Depression Gordon. We have a lot of ground to cover today. We have numerous guests who are going to be joining us on the program. We're going to be talking in just a minute or so about immigration, very much in the news recently, right? Do you know anything about the history of immigration and immigration laws here in the United States? Well, we'll be talking to a gentleman, Michael LeMay, who knows a whole lot about that. Also, we'll be talking about the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Are you familiar with that? Ed Perry will join us a little bit later on the program to talk about that. We'll take a few minutes to talk about parenting tips with Julie Morgenstern. And Tom Knights will also be joining us later on the program today. He'll have information on the upcoming Saxonburg Festival of the Arts. So, indeed, we have a lot of ground to cover here on the program today. We're going to be chatting with Michael LeMay by telephone. So what we're going to do here is take a break. We'll get hooked up with Dr. LeMay and be talking with him here in just a moment or so. Stick around. It's the Friday edition of It's Your Turn, and we'll be right back.
Dr. Jason Clark is an orthopedic surgeon for Butler Health System. He also volunteers as a high school team doctor.
We all hold our breath a little bit when our kids compete because we know there's always the chance of an injury. For Eric and Sydney, that was a severely injured ankle. Fortunately, I have quick access to the tools and the people they need, giving them the best opportunity to get back out there.
At Butler Health System, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to.
The Young Funeral Home of Butler invites you to stop by their Jefferson Street location downtown Butler to talk about pre-arrangements. Not the easiest thing to do, but necessary. And the Young family will walk you through the process, making it very comfortable and really easy to take care of. You'll experience peace of mind knowing that your wishes and plans will be carried out to the last detail. Call the Young Funeral Home in Butler today to make an appointment with a member of the Young family. Generations of the Young family have been caring for generations of Butler families for well over 40 years. The Young Funeral Home, West Jefferson Street in Butler. A subject, listeners, that's been in the news, gosh, for the past several years, and in particular over the last couple of years, since the Trump administration took over in Washington. The subject is immigration. If you're just joining us here on the It's Your Turn program on WISR, my name is Dave Mullarkey, and we're going to be talking about immigration with Dr. Michael LeMay, who is the author of a book entitled U.S. Immigration Policy, Ethnicity, and Religion in American History. Dr. LeMay, nice to meet you. Great to have you with us for a few minutes here today, sir.
Thank you, and I'm pleased to be a guest.
Well, as I mentioned, this subject has been in the news for quite a few years now, of course, a lot more in just the past couple of years, in fact, the last few months. Why do you think the U.S. Congress has been struggling so much with comprehensive immigration reform over the past decade?
Well, Congress is struggling to get anything done, any major legislation. They've got the major tax bill, but that's really the only major piece of legislation they've really passed here, largely because they're politically so polarized. Bipartisanship is very small now, just nowhere near what it used to be. And then the two parties have taken on immigration have taken such opposing positions, and neither party seems to be willing to compromise and accept some aspects that the other party considers essential. Well, I shouldn't say not completely, but that's the major direction you're in, what's called a policy conundrum. Mm-hmm. What is acceptable and might do some good with the issue the politicians won't adopt, if you will, and what they will adopt, one or the other party simply says no way, and so we've had this conundrum where we just can't seem to get anything done.
A little bit, listeners, about our guest, Dr. Michael LeMay is a professor emeritus at California State University, San Bernardino. He's been the chair of the political science department both at that school and also at Frostburg State University in Maryland. A lot of us are not up to date on immigration history such as you are. You've been studying this for some time, have you not, Dr. LeMay?
Yes, I have. Since 1985, my first book was on it was in 1985, and since then I've read and written books on the subject. I think I'm about 12 books now dealing with immigration policy. And in some senses, my interest goes all the way back to my childhood. My grandparents on both my mother and my father's side were immigrants, on my father's side from French-speaking Canada, hence the name LeMay. Mm-hmm. And on my mother's side, they were from Germany, northern Germany. And my grandmother, on my mother's side, lived with us for about the last 10 years of her life. She lived till 92, age 92. And she went suddenly blind when she was about 90. And I was a junior in high school, so my parents asked me to kind of be her primary caregiver rather than work outside the home, which I would have otherwise been doing. And I had the privilege of taking care of her for quite a number of months, and she talked a lot about, she kind of almost like reverted to her childhood in some respects, and she would talk about her being in Germany and life when she was 16, 17, before she came to the United States. So that kind of piqued my interest. I thought it was amazing that she, as a young woman, would leave Germany and come to the United States, So I got interested in it probably from that time on.
Hmm. Well, when you look at it, most of us, unless you're descended from Native Americans, most of us, if you go back far enough, are children of immigrants coming to what became the United States. You talk in your book in some detail, you separate immigration into a number of different periods. I understand from reading your book, and I did not know this, but it was 1820 where Congress passed the first actual immigration law in the U.S. I'm correct on that, Doctor?
Yes, you are. And in 1790, they passed the Uniform Naturalization Law governing how somebody who was not born here could become a citizen, naturalized. But the first actual law addressing the issue of immigration was, as you're mentioning, 1820, and it was simply called the Enumeration Law, or the Manifest Law, because it required simply the ship captains to supply a list, a manifest, of who was coming for permanent immigration, and was basically just trying to keep count in terms of numbers, but they weren't really regulating who could come in and who couldn't. Until much later.
I read, and I can't remember the source, but I've read this within the past couple of years because immigration has been such a topic in current events, and there's a fear that surfaces every so often about, other people, so to speak, other people in quotes, taking over our culture. But I read that in the early days of Pennsylvania, we're in western Pennsylvania, but in eastern Pennsylvania there was a tremendous influx of German immigrants, and there was a real fear, and this goes back to just post-colonial days, a fear that the German immigrants were...
Not even post-colonial, during colonial times.
Yeah. So this is, back in the Ben Franklin days in Philadelphia, there was a real fear that the Germans were going to take over and destroy American culture. So this goes back a long ways, doesn't it?
It sure does. And it goes I use a wave image in the book as well for various periods of time. So sometimes immigration goes up, and immediately after you get these spikes of increase in immigration, there's usually a period of fear of whatever immigrant group is or groups are dominating at that time. And so you get some laws to restrict, and the immigration comes down, and then over time it goes up again, and then comes down and goes up again, just sort of like waves. And we've feared first the Germans, and then it was the Irish. They were Catholic. They couldn't be assimilated. And then it was the Italians and Greeks or Eastern Europeans. And today it's the Muslims, for instance, or the Hispanics. And again, the fear with the Hispanic migration or immigration is that today that they will be so numerous that we will have, again, the problems similar to French-speaking Canada, which for a while was troubled, politically conflicted over whether the French-speaking part of Canada should break away and become its own country. And, there are a number of people who fear that will happen to the United States if we get too many Spanish-speaking people.
Mm-hmm.
That's never happened, and I don't think it's a very realistic fear, but it's there nonetheless, and it's politically influential.
And as we find out in your book, it's nothing new. We've been through this before many times. You, and it seems to me, I've seen a couple of these names before. You divide when you're talking about the history of immigration, the flow of immigration in the United States. You divide it into seven separate chapters, the first of which, starting in 1820, as we mentioned, is referred to as the Open Door Era. And that lasted for quite a while, about 60 years or so, I guess, huh?
Yes, that's really the longest period of time for a particular segment. And I characterize each era with a door image, because immigration policy performs kind of a gatekeeping function. Who will we let in or who will we not let in? And that suggested to me that door, a door metaphor or door image. And then I find a door image itself that kind of characterizes the area. So with the open door, as it implies, immigrants could just pretty much come. We had very few restrictions on who would enter. And then the second era, from 1880 to 1920, I call the door ajar era. And so the door is still open, and they're still coming in large numbers, but we're beginning to put on different restrictions, excluded categories, they're called, because we want to limit the number of immigrants coming from particular places. And then the pet door era, which is the 1920s to 1950s, as the pet door image implies, a little doggy door,
mm-hmm.
only the favored few can come in. So immigration overall is cut by more than half, and it tilts very strongly, the law on purpose, tilts the flow of immigration from Southern and Eastern Europe, which was dominated during the 1880s to 1920. It shifts it back to Northwestern Europe. European countries, and the other countries are restricted very much. They have very small quotas.
We need to take a quick break here. We've got some more time to chat with Dr. Michael LeMay. This is interesting stuff, folks. If you don't know a whole lot about the immigration history to the United States, there's also significant ties to ethnicity and to religion. And we'll pick that up when we return to pick up our conversation in just a moment or so. Dr. Michael LeMay with us, talking about his book, U.S. Immigration Policy, Ethnicity and Religion in American History. Here on It's Your Turn on WISR, we'll be back right after these words.
Have the thoughts of becoming a caregiver for your parents been on your mind a lot lately? Maybe you're thinking about your own life in a few years. Pretty overwhelming, and you don't know where to turn. Let me suggest attorney Michael Pater. He handles each account like they were his own mom and dad. For elder law issues, wills, power of attorney, living wills, trusts, and more, call attorney Michael Pater at the Handicap Accessible Morgan Center, downtown Butler, at 287-7724. Representing individuals, families, and businesses for over 26 years is attorney Michael Pater, 287-7724.
Do you have missing teeth or wear dentures? You may have heard of or are considering dental implants. Hi, this is Dr. Bob Todd of Butler Smiles Dental Care. There are many options available with dental implants, and making the right choice can be confusing. I have been placing dental implants since 2004, both full-size traditional implants and small diameter or mini dental implants. There are indications for both, but more and more we are using mini dental implants in a variety of innovative ways. They are easier to place, causing less discomfort, are less costly, and can frequently be used immediately after placement, allowing you to get back to eating the foods you like or smiling again right away. Traditional implants typically have a 4-month healing time before they can be used. I invite you to call our office at 282-7774 to schedule a free consultation to see if mini dental implants are the right solution for your dental problems, or visit us on the web at butlersmiles.com.
Welcome back. We're talking about immigration today. It's a subject that's been in the news a great deal over the past decade, and in particular over the last few months, with some controversy that's arisen with Trump administration policies, and we'll talk a little bit about those in just a moment or so. Our guest is Dr. Michael C. LeMay, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at both California State University at San Bernardino and at Frostburg State University in Maryland. I mentioned the ties to ethnicity and religion when you're talking about immigration history in the United States. My family is of Irish origin, Dr. LeMay, and so I know that...
No surprise there.
Yeah, with my last name, it's pretty obvious. But the biggest flow of Irish immigrants came during the middle of the 19th century, during the Big Potato Famine, which actually took place over a number of years in Ireland, but it was generally in the 1850s. You had alluded to this a little bit earlier in our conversation. The great fear was that because most of the Irish immigrants were Catholic, that they would not be assimilated in the United States, right?
That's correct. And incidentally, it was also a fear just because of the spike, the great increase in the numbers. 1848 to 1852 is kind of the famine ship era or period. And in that period of time, nearly 1.5 million, for sure 1.25 million. We don't have real accurate numbers yet, but at that point in time, but probably 1.25 million at least, Irish immigrants leave Ireland and come to the United States in 5 years. So places like Boston and New York and Philadelphia, you know, 1 year had few Irish, and you know, 3-4 years later they're teeming with them, and so it raised great fear. Part of it was their Catholicism, and part of it was mostly the Catholicism in terms of being able to assimilate, but also because they came, as you might expect with the famine ship and mm-hmm. or famine going on in Ireland, they were very poor when they got here. They basically had almost no money in their pocket at all when they got off the ships at the wharf and were processed. So there was a great fear that they would take jobs, drive wages down, et cetera, and working conditions down, because they literally would take any kind of job they could get. The Irish were very instrumental, incidentally, in building the Transcontinental Railroad from the East Coast towards the West, and Chinese immigrants, extremely important in as a labor force, to build the Transcontinental Railroad from the Pacific Coast East. And they met, as many people know, in Utah, laying the Golden Spike when the two ends of the railroad were joined. And in both cases, we could not have, or in that case, we literally could not have built our transcontinental railroad system without the immigrant labor.
Just, this is a bit parenthetical, but I know this from Irish history. The numbers are staggering in the years of the potato famine. Ireland had a total population of about 3 million people, and one-third of them, a little over 1 million, emigrated, the vast majority of them, to the United States. Just think about that for a minute. One-third of the population of the whole country leaving. Wow.
And if you count the number who died in the famine, didn't get a chance to leave. It's about half the total population. So in a five-year period of time, the population of Ireland reduced, as you said, from about 3 million to about a million and a half, maybe approaching a million and two-thirds or something. But but close to half the population disappeared, if you will, either through death or through emigration.
What about
and
the next?
Some emigrated.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, some came to the United States, most did. But also they went to Australia, they went to Canada, some went to South America, but mostly to the United States.
What about the next big wave of emigration to the United States? That was from Italy and Eastern European countries, was it not?
That was, you got it correct, that's what I call the Dutch door era. The immigrants from those countries are large in number. So the wave is, in fact, that period, 1880 to 1920, was the largest in terms of number in those decades, the greatest number in our history up until this most recent decades, right up until about 2000, 2010. Mm-hmm. So if you look just at a 10-year segment, then the 1900 to 1910, which includes those South Central Eastern Europeans, in the greatest number, they bought 65% of those tens of millions were from Southern and Eastern Europe.
Did these immigrants face the same sort of xenophobic attitudes that we saw toward the Irish a little earlier?
Yes, they did, and for similar reasons, although the diversity of religion was greater with them, cause greater numbers and coming from more varied sources. But just as the Irish instilled a fear of anti-Catholic, fear of Catholicism, in the 1880s, 1890s, the South and Southern and Eastern Europeans were Eastern Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, Italian Catholics, Asian immigrants coming in at that time with Asian religions. The Hasidic Jews and other Jews, but a large number of Jews as well. You have kind of almost like the Irish wave during the famine ships. You have Jewish immigrants fleeing pogroms or persecution in Eastern Europe, and they come in just a huge number as well, certainly approaching a million, probably over a million in a decade or two. And there's a natural reaction to that among some in the population that we just cannot digest or assimilate that many people, and they, in quotes, cannot or should not assimilate because of their religion or their, you know, some other social characteristic.
Mm-hmm. The Irish wave triggered in great part by the potato famine years. What about these others? Were there any triggers? Was there religious persecution going on that drove that wave of immigration, or what was the reason?
Religion certainly very important. I mentioned the pogroms against Jews, particularly Hasidic Jews, incidentally, who are more visible, simply. But you had Amish and Mennonites coming because of persecution there, and they would often move in entire communities. So you'd get 300 or 400 persons from a given village or city in the home country and come to a given place in the United States. So you have a sudden or marked increase in these people of, quote, strange religious beliefs coming and settling, and that raised particular fears in wherever they settled in large numbers. The other factor was Europe, and particularly at that point in time, Southern and Eastern Europe, is undergoing a economic transition. Your industrialization is hitting, and that causes a lot of social and economic turmoil in the home country. And sometimes the governments there deal with those tensions by encouraging emigration, encouraging people to leave, and then just millions of people decide, that's it, you know, I can't stay here any longer. The conditions are too bad, and I'll go to the United States as the land of golden opportunity, or the land where the streets are paved with gold. And I mentioned in the book, it's ironic that they got off the ships, and not only were the streets not paved with gold, in many cases when they're landing in big cities, the streets weren't paved, and they were the ones that did the paving.
Folks, I want to move on here. There's much, much more on the variety of different immigration periods. The China legislation is discussed in Dr. LeMay's book, but I want to move on to, before we totally run out of time here, to some more current issues. First of all, DACA. This has been in the news recently. Where do you think that's going to end up, Dr. LeMay? Do you have any idea, the whole DACA legislation thing? Is it in fact going to be thrown out, or is it going to be revised, or what do you think is going to happen?
Okay, that's a very interesting question. If your listeners are not aware, DACA stands for Deferred Action on Childhood Arrivals, and it refers to people who were brought here as young children, usually less than teenage, and by their parents who came here unauthorized or illegally. And they've lived all their life in the United States, and they want to become citizens, but because their status is illegal, unless you have a change, they would be, if they were found, they could be expelled. And so the Obama administration tried to get through what was called Dreamer legislation. Those children were referred to as the Dreamers, the DACA children. Mm-hmm. And he couldn't get it through Congress, and so he just used executive action to defer the cracking down on them to try and expel them, and said, well, we won't seek to expel you. But there's proposals still before Congress to try and have congressional action to give them legal status, to change their status from unauthorized to authorized. So it would give them eventually a chance to be naturalized, to become U.S. citizens. Right now, the Supreme Court has put a hold on the Trump administration's enforcement of trying to stop DACA completely. And Trump himself has said we should have congressional action, but they cannot seem to get it together to pass a law. And I don't think anything will be passed unless or until you have a significant change in which is the majority party in Congress. So if in the midterm elections coming up in November, you get a wave of Democrats that they're talking about, the blue wave, then I think after that's over, you would probably have, with the new Congress, you would probably have movement to pass some kind of comprehensive immigration reform that would deal with the DACA children.
Did previous sessions of Congress battle over this throughout American history, or is this a particular battle relatively unique?
Well, it's a battle in terms of timing and the specific aspect, the DACA thing, because DACA was an executive action. And so the conflict now is that constitutionally legal? Can presidents do what Obama did? And that's a legal question that's seized upon, and many Republicans say, no, he could not or should not have done that, and Democrats say it's perfectly within the power of a president. We've had executive orders throughout history that have done that kind of thing, not specifically for the children, but where the executive changes, if you will, the immigration law, or the way, it's, he really is not changing the law. He's changing the way it is being implemented.
I see.
We've had that in the past.
I've been,
sometimes adversely, so we've used that against Japanese Americans after or during World War II, where we rounded up them and incarcerated them in the internment camps, for instance.
One final
by executive order.
One final question, Doctor. Our time is expiring here, but you talk about Ellis Island in your book. Most folks will be familiar with that name. Do you know how long Ellis? I know it's shut down now, and it has been. Do you know how long Ellis Island was actually open as the prime immigration port?
Yes, in 1892 is when it is first opened, and it lasts until 1952.
Mm-hmm.
So from 1892 to 1952, it is and was the largest receiving station of immigrants in the world. During that period of time, approximately 68% to 69% of all the immigrants, and we're talking millions, of all the immigrants coming to the United States come through Ellis Island. Between 1907, for instance, is the year that you have the largest number. In 1 year's time, more than 1 million 700,000, I think it is. No, 1,007,000 come through Ellis Island in 1 year alone.
Fantastic. Folks,
staggering amount. When you,
all kinds of...
When you figure it.
Believe it or not, folks, I just scratched the surface of the stuff that's in Dr. LeMay's book. Here's the title again, U.S. Immigration Policy, Ethnicity, and Religion in American History. It is a fascinating book by Dr. Michael C. LeMay. Dr. LeMay, great to talk with you today. Boy, this was interesting. Thanks for being with us, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be your guest.
Boy, I learned a lot about immigration chatting with him, huh? Michael LeMay. Much more to come on It's Your Turn today. We're going to be talking, coming up next, about the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Ed Perry will be our next guest. Stick around to more of It's Your Turn on a Friday, right after these words. For so many of us, a loving pet is, well, it's a member of the family, isn't it? If you're looking for a veterinarian you can trust when it comes time for a checkup or treatment for a pet that's ill, consider Suburban Animal Clinic and Dr. Dennis Damon, Route 8 south of Butler, 4 miles south of Butler, right at the intersection of Route 8 South and Thorncrest Drive. Dr. Damon treats small animals, dogs, cats, all small animals, and exotic pets, too. If you have a question about illness, symptoms, shots, a checkup, if you need to talk to someone about concerns with an aging pet or a pet near the end of life, you can trust Dr. Dennis Damon. He loves animals. He's a pet owner himself. Dr. Dennis Damon, veterinarian at Suburban Animal Clinic. Hours by appointment only, Monday through Saturday. Credit cards are accepted, and he makes house calls, too. Dr. Dennis Damon, Suburban Animal Clinic, Route 8, 4 miles south of Butler at the intersection of Route 8 and Thorncrest Drive. Phone 287-5289.
Losing a loved one is unbearable. It makes us feel so alone, so helpless. We ask ourselves, does anybody really understand how we feel? Thompson Miller Funeral Home in Butler offers a unique, sensitive program called Someone's Caring. It's been structured to help ease your emotional pain. There are group sessions with people who truly understand how you feel because they feel the same way. And being together helps. Men and women are invited to attend. For over 20 years, we've helped hundreds and hundreds of people cope with these intense feelings. We offer 5 programs, a grief support group for those who have lost a loved one, for survivors of a suicide, for bereaved parents, for those who have lost a pet, and individual sessions. They're conducted by our own trained bereavement specialist, Robin S. Miller. Call us at Thompson Miller, 724-287-3706, 287-3706. We can help. Thompson Miller Funeral Home at the corner of East North and McCain Streets in downtown Butler. Thompson Miller, time-honored excellence.
Next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Malarkey, if you're just joining us, and we're pleased to be able to chat for a few minutes with Ed Perry, who is an aquatic biologist and environmental advocate for Pennsylvania, with the National Wildlife Federation and State Conservation Organization. First of all, Ed Perry, nice to meet you. Great to have you with us for a few minutes here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Dave.
I understand that we're close to a deadline here. You're starting a campaign for hopefully some last-minute action by people, right?
Yes, we're trying to get the Land and Water Conservation Fund permanently reauthorized at the full $900 million level.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this fund. A lot of folks might not be familiar with it, the Land and Water Conservation Fund. It was initially authorized, actually it was quite some time ago when it was initially authorized by Congress, right?
Yes, it was reauthorized and it was authorized initially back in 1965, so it's been in operation for about 54 years.
It was initially supposed to run out in September of 2015, but it did not. What was it, emergency extension or something?
Yes, they had been reauthorizing it starting in 1965 at 25-year intervals. And then in September of 2015, they only reauthorized it for 3 years. And now it's set to expire on September 30th of this year.
So unless there's action, it will go out of existence. First of all, and this is very important for listeners to know, and I was not aware of this, there are no tax dollars funding this, correct? Am I right on that, Ed?
You're exactly right. The monies that go into the fund come from the royalty payments that the drillers in the Gulf of Mexico have to pay the government for taking oil and gas reserves that belong to the United States, and also for polluting the Gulf of Mexico, which we know has been huge. Just think back to the BP oil spill.
Mm-hmm. So no taxpayer dollars are used for this fund. So, you know, when you know that, what's the big deal? Why, for heaven's sakes, why would it not be extended?
It's really puzzling why this thing is not being reauthorized right now. There's 230 co-sponsors in the House. Evidently, the holdup seems to be in the leadership of this Congress that isn't bringing it to the floor for whatever reason. And you know, people should know this is really the best conservation program that most people have never heard of. The money from the fund, just in Pennsylvania, for example, there's been over 1,500 projects funded all across the state to the tune of over $350 million. And every community has benefited from this fund. The town of, you know, Butler, five parks in Butler have gotten over $750,000 of Land and Water Conservation Fund. The one park, Alameda Park,
yes,
has
mm-hmm.
gotten over $500,000.
Wow. That's our biggest county park, by the way, and I'm sure you wouldn't be familiar with that, Ed, but Alameda Park is our biggest county park. It's over 300 acres. $500,000 from this fund. I didn't know that either. Wow. Are there other organizations who are joining forces to try to urge people to do something about this? I mean, there are lots of other conservation groups that are teaming up with you, right?
You know, it's amazing the broad-based coalition that is supporting reauthorization of the fund. We have groups from Penn Future, Penn Environment, Sierra Club, National Wildlife Federation, to Backcountry Hunters and Anglers, and Trout Unlimited. So there's a lot of hunters and anglers groups that are supporting this, groups that support Civil War battlefields. There's been all of the Civil War battlefields have gotten Land and Water Conservation Fund money. The Flight 93 Memorial at Shanksville has got $10 million of land and water conservation fund money. So all of these groups that support historic sites, playgrounds, ball fields, national wildlife refuges, national parks, every group has some interest in these American landmarks are supporting the Land and Water Conservation Fund.
I'm assuming, I don't have any info on this, but if in fact the fund is not reauthorized, the money's still going to be coming in. It's not taxpayer dollars. It's revenues from offshore oil and gas royalty. What will Congress do with it if they're not going to reauthorize this fund? What will they do with the money? The money's going to keep coming in, right?
It will, and it will go into the black hole of the federal treasury. You know, what's interesting, over the course of this fund, 54 years, it's gotten about supposedly would have gotten about $48 billion. Nearly half of that has not been spent. It's gone into the federal treasury. Just as an example, I think in 2013, the federal government got over almost $3 billion in royalty payments. Yet the next year, the Land and Water Conservation Fund only got about $350 million. So Congress has been allowing a substantial portion of that money to go into the federal treasury when it is supposed to be used for to preserve, create, and ensure access to outdoor recreation for all Americans.
How is this money distributed? Do you know anything about this? I mean, do various municipalities or park and recreation areas apply for grants, or how is it distributed?
Well, there's kind of two groups of money. One goes to the state, and it's administered by the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources, and communities all across the state, municipalities and Parks Department, can apply for grants to the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. That's where a lot of these, most of these 1,500 projects have been funded. The other pot of money is just federal money, and that has gone to establish like the Cherry Valley National Wildlife Refuge, or that Flight 93 Memorial at Shanksville, or the Tinicum National Wildlife Refuge, or any of the national parks all across our country. So if you're, what I don't understand is why every municipality and every parks department and every county in our state is not asking their representative and their senators to permanently reauthorize this the Land and Water Conservation Fund at the full $900 million level. Because, like you keep pointing out, there's no taxpayer money involved. This is money that the drillers owe the American people for taking a resource that belongs to all of Americans.
Does this fund, I was not aware, I was not knowledgeable on any of the history of it, does this predate the Clean Water Act, or did this come into effect at about the same time? Obviously, this is separate from the Clean Water Act, which was somewhere around 1970, I believe.
Yes, the Clean Water Act was passed in 1972, and the Land and Water Conservation Fund was passed in 1965.
Oh,
so it predates the Clean Water Act.
Yeah. Well. So, yeah. The bottom line, I'm sure many of our listeners are hearing about this for the first time. The deadline is rapidly approaching. Here we are already a week into September, and the deadline, the expiration deadline is the end of the month, September 30th. What would you suggest that people do if they're so inclined to have this extended it?
Well, you know, I've worked on organizing now for the past 12 years. I've met a lot of congressional representatives in the district offices, and they all tell me if they get just 10 phone calls on an issue, that is enough for them to flag that for their bosses, the local representative. So I would encourage people to pick up the phone and just call their representative and Senator Casey and Senator Toomey and just say, we want the Land and Water Conservation Fund permanently reauthorized at the full $900 million level.
You, before your retirement, you were an aquatic biologist, Ed Perry. What does that entail? What did you do?
Well, we did stream and wetland protection all throughout the state. In fact, we were funded by both the Army Corps of Engineers and the Environmental Protection Agency to work on stream and wetland protection for them because we were so good at it. And so I traveled all around the state working on projects that were proposed to fill in waters of the United States and also projects that were done illegally without benefit of state or federal permits.
Mm-hmm. I know that a number of highway projects used to be done without concern for wetlands, elimination of wetlands. Now we realize how important they are. And most highway projects, you have to get approval for that, right? If you're going to damage or destroy a wetland, you have to create a new one somewhere.
Yes, absolutely. The landscape for wetlands and protection has changed dramatically from when I first started working for the government in 1974. Back then, it was essentially a free-for-all that people pretty much filled in wetlands and moved streams around at will. And now today, everyone pretty well knows the value of wetlands, and they know if they work in streams or wetlands, they need federal or state permits.
Okay, so once again, listeners, if you're so inclined, you can. It's more important to contact local members of Congress or senators, U.S. senators, or both. Ed, which do you think would be most effective?
Oh, you definitely would want to contact your local, your federal representatives, not state or local. Definitely contact your federal representatives.
Well, for the bulk of our listeners, that would be Congressman Mike Kelly, who's a native of Butler, by the way, represents the 3rd Congressional District. Those numbers are all going to change as we move into the next election cycle, but right now Congressman Mike Kelly would be the representative for most of the people listening to us at the moment. Ed Perry, thanks very much. I was not aware of this. In fact, well, as you said, I'm not alone. I was not familiar with the Land and Water Conservation Fund. Thanks for opening our eyes to this and letting us know about the upcoming deadline, Ed.
Thanks for having me on, Dave.
Sure.
Appreciate it.
Sure. Good to talk with you, my friend. Thanks a lot. So long now.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Our hands and wrists are in motion nearly every minute of every day. So when you develop pain, everyday tasks become a problem. And although the causes of pain may vary, the orthopedic hand and upper extremity surgeons at Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers diagnose and treat a wide array of conditions. To learn more about hand and upper extremity care, visit TriRiversMSK.com or call 1-866-874-7483. Tri-Rivers Musculoskeletal Centers, partnering with the Butler community for more than 20 years.
Great products at greatly reduced prices is exactly what you'll find at Sharp Shopper Grocery Outlet. You'll find many of your favorite name brand grocery items, as well as fresh produce, frozen and refrigerated foods, and much more. All items 100% satisfaction guaranteed. Sharp Shopper has been bringing bargains to Pennsylvania communities for 30 years. Be sure to visit their new Butler store location in Point Plaza. Sharp Shopper Grocery Outlet, a new way to shop, a new way to save.
Talking listeners on the next segment of It's Your Turn here on WISR. My name is Dave Mullarkey. Our guest is Julie Morgenstern, who joins us by telephone. We're talking about time to parent, organizing your life to bring out the best in your child and you. This is a new book, Julie, Time to Parent, right?
Yes, brand new book. Mm-hmm. Just came out this week.
Well, you've published a lot of them on this topic. Specifically, we're talking here in this book about just how much attention kids need to feel loved and secure. And it's kind of a balancing game, isn't it, Julie? I mean, obviously, parents, no matter how conscientious they are, they can't devote every waking minute to the child.
No, and in fact, I think that our belief that we should be, or and not knowing how much is enough, actually is a trap that parents fall into. It's sort of, I think, the biggest problem with parenting is, without clear parameters and not, the job is so ambiguous. There's no job manual, right? There's no instruction manual for kids. And if you don't know how much is enough, you never can relax, and you spend a lot of time, whatever you're doing, you feel like you're neglecting something else. So I am a time management and organizing expert, and I decided I was going to address this need for an instruction manual, a time management manual of how do you manage the conflicting priorities and be there for your kids as well as your job, as well as yourself. It's a time management problem, but I had to find out from the experts, because I'm not a parenting expert. I had to find out how much time and attention kids need. And it was very hard to find the answer, Dave. No one really wanted to commit. Everybody's gray area. It depends on the kid, the family, the circumstances. But that's not going to help a parent manage their time. Ambiguity is a recipe for overwork and inefficiency and insecurity. So I dug and I dug and I dug thousands of pages of studies, 70 years of human development research, and I found the answer. And it's very liberating. What kids need to feel loved and secure is short bursts of undivided attention delivered regularly, consistently. And when I say short bursts, what I mean is 5 to 15 or 20 minutes at a time, max. And delivered regularly means sort of at the regular cadence of their day, when they wake up in the morning, when they go off to school, either when they get home from school or you get home from work, at dinner, at bedtime. Kids have, experts say, they have short attention spans, and experts say calculate roughly a minute for every age of life.
Hmm.
Fascinating.
Yes.
And it makes so much sense, right? A one-year-old has 1 minute of attention span, and then they're like looking at the next shiny object, right? A five-year-old, 5 minutes. A 15-year-old, 15 minutes. And if you are giving them what they really want, and studies of what kids want reveal this, they want your undivided, they don't need a lot of time, but when they need your time or when you are giving them time, they don't want it divided. They don't want it where they're asking you a question, you're talking to them, or you're playing a game that you find, whatever, boring, you know, and you're also on your cell phone, or your mind is drifting to your to-do list, or worries about work. All they want is, when you are spending time with me, give me your undivided attention. And that shows kids that they matter, that they're valued, and valuable to you.
And it also,
kind of what we all need.
As you mentioned, it's liberating, because parents, if they understand this, then they don't have to feel guilty about not being totally attentive every minute of the day.
Exactly. And you don't have to feel guilty working. Actually, no study has ever revealed there's any detriment to kids that parents work. Kids don't mind if parents work. The problem we have is we feel so guilty about work that we send our kids conflicting messages about work. And we may love our jobs, right? We may love our work. It gives us meaning. But what we say to our kids, because we feel so guilty about not being with them, is, I really hate, you know, I really wish I didn't have to work. I'm so sorry I have to go to work. It so sucks that I have to work. But I have to make money to pay for your life. So that's, right? And then kids are like, wow, mom or dad hates their job, but they're only doing it for me. That's not the message you want to give kids. They don't need that. They want to know you love your work. They just don't want you to love your work more than you love them.
Our guest listeners, Julie Morgenstern, is the author of several New York Times best-selling books on parenting and time management, and she was a former guest on the Oprah Winfrey Show. That must have been something, being with Oprah. Hey, Julie.
Oh, yeah. She's fabulous. Wonderful. It was on many times on the show, actually, and it was just great.
In your latest book, Time to Parent, you talk about different types of parent time and self time. Can you discuss those for a minute or so?
Sure. So when you think about what you have to divide your time between during the parenting years, the different roles, break it into two parts. Raising a human and being a human. You are responsible for both. Under the raising a human, each of those have four components. So under raising a human, you have to divide your time between providing for your children, right, making money and managing money, arranging the logistics of their lives, transportation and schedules and school forms, etc., relating to your children, connecting to them as the unique individuals, getting to know who they are, and teaching them, which is guiding them with values and life skills. That's four components: provide, arrange, relate, teach. It spells the acronym PART, as in doing your part for another person. That's raising. On being a human, you have four components to juggle your time between in order to thrive as a human. And that is sleep, right, to get the rest you need. Exercise, which is to be fit, the muscles and the tissues and the oxygen in the brain and fitness. Love, which is your adult love relationships. And fun, which is the activities that just make you you and bring joy to your life, and, like, you know, the instant you do them, you're happy or you're relaxed. And those spell an acronym SELF: sleep, exercise, love, fun. And that's it. When you look at that and think about it, those eight things, four for yourself and four for your kids, encompass everything you need to juggle your time between for the full span from the birth of your first kid till the launch of your last. That's it. Nothing else. It's not 8,000 things. It's not an infinite amount. It's eight. And that is also very liberating.
You also talk, Julie, in your book, Time to Parent, about what many parents do wrong. Can you talk about that a little bit? What do many parents do wrong?
I think, you know, one of them is it's certainly that they have their cell phones a little too close, right? So we are all addicted to these screens. It's physiologically proven. We're mindlessly just trying to get stuff done, or we escape, you know, kind of the boredom, because actually spending time with kids can be boring, less stimulating, depending on what they want to do. So separate yourself, and really you've got to become, in your household, a media mentor. That is the way to think about it. And be mindful about when you have phones and when you don't, and be fully present and get that thing out of your hands. Because when you do that, your kids are going to end up, before you know it, I can't tell you how many parents are like, yeah, now my kids, I can't get their attention because they're addicted to their phones. So create really clear rules about that. And don't confuse teaching with relating. There's a very big difference. And from a child's point of view, that their experience, when you're teaching your child, you're bringing them into the adult world, right? And they are the student of you. When you are relating to your child, you are entering your child's world, and you are the student of them. Mm. Yeah. And teaching is much easier when you are really good at relating. When you are a student of your child, and they feel seen and recognized, and they can just be, and they feel valued and valuable, and you know them, then the teaching, they'll follow you wherever you want to go in the teaching. And you also know them, so you know where to, you know, when to say something, what they're really struggling with. And parents often feel the burden also of, like, I need to teach my kid. And that feels like love, and it is loving, right? It's loving to teach and guide your kids. But if every encounter with them, you're teaching them and they are the student of you, it's exhausting to them and they never feel seen or recognized.
Final question, sure, Julie. Our time begins to run a little short here, and I know you're on a tight schedule. Is it ever too late? I mean, maybe a parent feels like they didn't do a very good job. They did a bad job.
Yeah.
Is it ever too late to become a good parent?
It is absolutely never too late to change and to reconnect. And this is, science tells us, this is another one of these fallacies where we all heard, you know, it's the first 7 years of life, you're set for your whole life, and what a cruel joke from nature that, you know, the early years are the only most important ones when we're the least experienced. We all make mistakes. We all had the balance wrong. You know, it's so, and you can hit reset at any point. If you're entering this and your kids are 8 and the last 8 years you have been, you know, distracted with work and arranging and logistics and not spending enough time with your kids, kids want and need to connect. They want to be the apple of your eye, and you can hit reset at any point. And the and science tells us the brain is continuing to, they have discovered recently, the brain and the cells in the brain are they're plastic, and they continue to grow well into adulthood. So the early years matter, but the later years also matter very, very much, and you can always hit reset. And, you know, interestingly, the solutions are surprisingly simple and quick to implement. It takes time for results. If you're reentering your kid's life at the age of 14, you can expect some resistance, no doubt. But just be patient and hack at it, and the techniques in the book will help you to show up and really be there. Kids want to be seen and valued. They want to know that they're important to you, and they will connect. Everyone is resilient. We're all resilient. Never give up, really.
Good advice, folks. The title of the book is Time to Parent by Julie Morgenstern. She's been our guest on It's Your Turn for the last few minutes. Nice to meet you, Julie. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you, Dave.
Sure. Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Dr. Andrew Szabo of Butler Health System with the story of a remarkable recovery.
Joe's never the kind to be still for long. A hernia can stop that in a hurry. The technology we use makes surgery less invasive, and that makes recovery less challenging. That's a big investment for a community hospital. But then again, we're not the average community hospital.
At Butler Health System, we know what it takes to provide the very best of care. But more importantly, we know why we have to.
Welcome back, friends. We move into the final segment of the It's Your Turn program today. I told you at the beginning we had a lot of ground to cover today, and it's been very interesting so far. And it will be for our last segment, too. We welcome Tom Knights here in the studio at It's Your Turn. We're going to be talking about the Saxenburg Festival of the Arts. Tom, good to see you. Nice to have you here today.
Good to see you. Thank you, Dave.
This is the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, for the Saxenburg Festival of the Arts, right?
Yes, it is.
I've always loved this festival. I like arts festivals to begin with, but it always seems to me that this is just about the right size.
It is. It's right size. It's the right character, the right composition. It's just a really great event.
There are other arts festivals around. Certainly a good one in Pittsburgh, the Three Rivers at the beginning of June, but that's pretty big these days. And I've been to the Nittany Mountain Arts Festival up at Penn State, and that's just become gargantuan. You know, that's too big, really. Saxenburg's just the right size.
It is. The average attendance at the Arts Festival almost doubles the town's population.
Mm.
So, you know, looking at that in perspective, very welcoming, both the vendors and the town residents as a whole.
So it's this weekend, 2 days, Saturday, Sunday. Do you know the hours offhand, Tom?
I do. Saturday is from 10 to 6, and Sunday's from noon to 5.
Mm-hmm. So really a longer chance to visit on Saturday.
It is.
Longer hours.
Saturday also involves the Rodfather's Car Show on Main Street.
Oh, good, yeah.
So that's unique to Saturday.
We know the Rodfathers. They're the best.
They are. Yeah. Put on a good show.
Yeah. So that's on Saturday. Huh?
Correct.
Okay. Is there an admission charge, by the way?
There is not. There's no admission fees.
So if you wanted to buy a cold drink or something, you could do that, but there's no admission charge to get in.
That's right. Yep.
Is it any problem for parking?
Multiple places to park. The Saxenburg Fire Department is often very gracious about using their traditionally carnival parking lot off of Horn Avenue.
Mm-hmm.
The Knox School District, they actually offer their parking space along Dinner Bell Road in front of the high school. That's another good option for folks. Mm-hmm. Those are probably the two largest parking areas available. And shuttles are running from there as well.
I was going to say they're both within walking distance, but shuttles are even better.
Much better at times, yeah. Especially if you're carrying a lot of purchases.
That's true, yeah. So don't worry about that. You can park in the traditional carnival parking lot or at Knock High School and take a shuttle into town. Where does the Saxonburg Festival of the Arts take place? Is it all over town? Or?
Concentrated in the east side of town. So there are outdoor vendors at Roebling Park itself. Mm-hmm. There are vendors inside Cooper Hall, which is a building at Roebling Park.
Yeah, it's right there, yeah.
There's also several vendors that are set up on Main Street itself in First Commonwealth Bank's parking lot. They're gracious enough to let us use their parking lot space for vendors. So pretty much concentrated the east end of town for vendors and, of course, local businesses on Main Street as well.
So what will visitors to Saxonburg see this weekend? You mentioned the Rodfather's Car Show, part of it tomorrow. There'll be lots of art and photography, I guess, huh?
Lots of art, lots of photography, lots of crafts. Been a pretty good influx of interactive activities, especially for kids.
Oh.
Sand combining and face painting, those types of things. So really, really good for kids of all ages. You'll also find some Civil War reenactment going on.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yep, across the road from Roebling Park itself. Rolling Times, but you'll see that as well.
That's always interesting. These reenactors, I'm not one of them. I'm not involved in that, but I've talked to some of them, and they really take this reenacting seriously.
Yes, they do.
Down to the appropriate apparel, you know. In fact, it's even more than that. I was talking to one guy, and he said, we're so fastidious, we make sure we have the right kind of buttons.
Yeah.
Not only the right kind of coat or the tunic or whatever, but the right kind of buttons.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this will be Civil War reenactors.
Correct. Yep.
Good. Will that be both days or?
It'll be both days at different times.
I see. Okay.
Yep.
And you'll be able to see that because it's right across the street from the from Roebling Park.
Like you'll see it and probably hear it. Yeah.
That's right. I forgot. Civil War reenactors. Well, listen, that's a great history lesson for anybody, especially the young ones.
Sure it is.
See that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And the reenactors, between their demonstrations, they always like to talk to people and so on, so you're welcome to go up and
Found them welcome to answer questions.
Yeah, yeah, ask questions about their uniforms or their weapons or whatever. They're knowledgeable. The art and the photography be inside or outside, Tom?
Most of it's outside. Mm-hmm. Vendors are pretty well spaced throughout the area so that there's no one concentration of same products in one area.
Mm-hmm.
Encourage people to walk around, see the entire facility, see the full layout. Hard to say what you'll see around each corner, so...
Most of the vendors and those who are displaying have a tent-like thing, you know, canopies.
Most of them have some kind of sheltering over everything. Mm-hmm. Yep. So you can get off the walking area into their particular vendor space, get a chance to look over what their goods are.
Is this a juried art show? Are there awards, Tom Knights?
Right now, I'm not aware of awards that the festival committee is issuing. Whether each individual vendor does or not, that's really up to them.
Mm-hmm. Who sponsors the Saxonburg Festival of the Arts?
It's actually a Saxonburg borough function. It's administered by the Saxonburg Historical Restoration Committee, which is a borough entity that spends a ton of time, energy, and money maintaining the park, the facility, the upkeep, the maintenance. So this is that committee's largest fundraiser. Funds actually go back into maintaining the park.
And they've done a lot over the years in Saxonburg, that historical and restoration committee commission. I've talked with some of them over the years, and they've really tried to ensure that the history of Saxonburg is well known and remains as.
Sure, and that's a great segue. During the arts festival hours, both Saturday and Sunday, the museum is open as well.
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't got an opportunity to see what's actually in the museum, it's worth your time going through. There's some real interesting exhibits in there.
And that's right down in the park. So.
It's actually in Roebling Park. It would be adjacent to Cooper Hall, separate entrance. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, I've visited that museum. In fact, time that I was there, I wished I had more time.
Sure.
Because yeah. It's fascinating to look through the exhibits. Nice for a town of Saxonburg's size to have such a, what amounts to a timeline of history. There's displays in there of the Saxonburg Fire Department and even some of their old-time, long, long-ago equipment, which
sure.
looks primitive by today's standards, but it's kind of neat to look at. So the museum, will it be open on weekend?
It will be. It'll actually be open both Saturday and Sunday.
Okay.
During the same hours at the during the festival.
So yep. Attendees are welcome to stop at the museum if they want to.
Absolutely.
Give yourself a little time for that, folks, because that is fascinating. I am a bit of a local history buff, but even for folks who are not, it's fun.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it is.
We're talking with Tom Knights. Tom, are you on the committee or the commission, or how are you connected with this, Tom?
Volunteer.
Okay.
I'm actually a borough councilman and wanted to make sure I was, contributing to this particular event. I've already personally enjoyed it even before being an elected official, so just wanted to pitch in, help. And the overall festival committee itself made up of great people that have put in a ton of time and energy into it. One of the best things I've had this year is the logistics of putting this on.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody looks at the fun. There's always a lot of sweat and energy and time behind the scenes.
And for a town the size of Saxonburg, it's not real big.
Nope.
It's part of its charm, but that means you really have to get a lot of cooperation from the people who live there and the people on the businesses that are there to put on something like this. It's not like you're, I've got 500,000 people to pick from to form your committees and so on.
That's right. Yeah, you really covet those that are willing to volunteer that kind of time.
33rd Annual Saxonburg Festival of the Arts. Let's see, back 33 years. Mid-80s, I guess that would be, right? Yeah, mid-80s. Yeah. You used to be able to do that at the drop of a hat, but since we're into the new millennium, you have to add, subtract, and all that stuff. I have to think about it for a little bit. Yeah, 33 years would mean 1986 for the first festival.
Sounds correct.
Yeah. And originally organized, even way back then, by the Saxonburg Historical and Restoration Commission?
Correct. Hmm.
Is that a group that's been involved, or is this another group that's been involved with some of the recent work on Main Street, the sidewalks and the lights and so on?
Separate group.
Oh, a separate group?
Yep, mm-hmm. It is a separate group. Saxonburg Historical Restoration Committee really, really zeroed in at the park itself.
Mm-hmm.
That's their primary caretaking. And, along with the festival, that same committee also oversees park rentals there at Cooper Hall as well. There's a very large, really nice gazebo there that draws in a lot of outdoor events. Certainly a great place for photography. That committee is in that general park area along with all the buildings, just maintaining that. And that in and of itself is a large task.
The namesake of Cooper Hall is Reldon Cooper, I'm guessing.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
Longtime civic leader and leader of industry in Saxonburg as well.
Sure was. Contributed an awful lot to where the park is today. Yeah. Yes.
Contributed a lot to where the town is today.
Sure did.
Frankly.
Yeah.
He was mayor for a while, wasn't he?
He was. Time. Yep. Yeah. Longtime mayor.
And the Saxonburg trolley, wasn't that part of his doing?
That was an initiative his as well. Yep. Mm-hmm. There's actually some remnants, I believe, in the museum right now.
Mm-hmm. The trolley doesn't run anymore?
It does not, no.
Trolleys don't run anymore in many, many places.
Yeah.
The city of Butler had trolley service at one time, way back when.
Yep.
We're chatting with Tom Knights. He's a volunteer, one of many, many people who work tirelessly to bring you the Saxonburg Festival of the Arts. which is this coming weekend, Roebling Park, Cooper Hall, and Main Street in Saxonburg. We'll talk a little bit more about it in a moment or so. While I have the opportunity to chat with Tom Knights, he is the new township manager in Butler Township. So a few questions about that after we take a quick break here. Sponsors on our It's Your Turn program include Miller Shoes. Miller Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. 125 years they've been around. Stop and think about that for a minute now. Wow. I mean, we have businesses that have been around for a while, but 125 years. That's phenomenal, huh? Miller Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. Stop in, take a look. They always have a wide variety of men's and ladies' shoes on sale and on racks for easy browsing. And they are certainly your headquarters for athletic shoes. Miller's has all your famous brands, Nike and New Balance and Saucony and Rockport and Keds and Skechers and Easy Spirit and Asics. I can remember when I was a kid, it was like Keds and that was it. Look at all those famous name brands you'll find at Miller's under one roof. No need to go to three or four different places. Miller's Shoes. They're also your headquarters for SAS Comfort Shoes, America's favorite comfort shoe. And they are made in the U.S. And you can't say that about too many shoes anymore. SAS, made in America. And their comfort shoes are fantastic. They also have sandals, just as comfortable of their as their shoes. I feel like bedroom slippers, really. And they come in a variety of styles and colors for men and women. Stop in, take a look at SAS Comfort Shoes and Sandals at Miller's Shoes, 215 South Main Street in downtown Butler. They literally have fitted generations of families in our area with shoes. Always a great selection, always a good price, and always a friendly smile from the Ciprians at Miller's Shoes. Another one of our sponsors is Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. Have you tried them yet, folks? I have. If you have items that you have to get ready and package up for shipping, they'll do it for you. You don't have to worry about hunting around for the right size box. This was too big, this was too little. Or the bubble wrap, or, you know, those styrofoam peanuts, or the mailing label. Forget about it. You don't have to do it. Just take your items to Going Postal Butler. They'll package them up and ship them for you. Any way you want, by the way. U.S. Postal Service, or if you prefer UPS or FedEx, they'll handle it. They also have copying service, scanning service, faxing service. You can rent a temporary mailbox there. There's even an official notary in case you have to get something notarized before it's shipped out. Oh, and you can grab a jar of local honey, too. Delicious. They're open Monday through Friday, Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center, Monday through Friday, located at 140 Shockey Lane. That's just off Newcastle Road here in Butler. It's in the Shockey Mini Storage Complex. Follow the signs, you'll get there. It's right behind King's and Villa Grande restaurants. You know where it is there, off Newcastle Road. Call them at 724-841-0044. Going Postal Butler, your friendly neighborhood shipping center. We're chatting with Tom Knights. Tom is here. He's a volunteer, has been involved for some years with the Saxonburg Festival of the Arts. But Tom has recently been appointed as the new township manager in Butler Township. You're not on the job too long there, are you, Tom?
No, about 6 weeks now.
Mm-hmm. So are you blending in? Are you liking it so far?
Oh, it's great job, great staff, great support all the way around.
Ed Kirkwood was your predecessor.
He was.
Who just retired this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
You, of course, met him, I assume, sometimes.
Worked with him for, you know, 4 years prior to my appointment. Mm-hmm. Learned a lot from him. Great resource. Still resource I can count on today.
Mm-hmm. So for listeners who may not be familiar with the responsibilities of a township manager, I guess in a nutshell, you could say, even though in this case, Butler Township obviously is governed by a board of commissioners. There are five of them, I think.
Correct. Yep.
I used to cover their meetings a long, long time ago, not anymore. And that's the governing body. Those are the elected individuals, the township commissioners. But for the everyday run-of-the-mill operations, day-to-day operations, that's your job, right? You're the township manager.
That is my job. All departments that are comprise the municipal government of Butler Township.
Mm-hmm. Road department, so on.
Road department, zoning, finance. Mm-hmm. Finance is a real large part of day-in, day-out tasks that I have.
Mm-hmm.
Involve police department. And then all the peripheral governing agencies, actually being the conduit, speak with equivalency of commissioners and for the commissioners in some regard to these separate state, even federal agencies, get the direction from the elected officials and then carry on their direction.
Do you have various department heads, like a head of streets and roads department or something like that?
We're actually in the process of hiring that. So that would be my direct replacement. So there's a superintendent for the road department. Zoning officer actually is the department head for zoning, codes, fire marshal.
Mm-hmm.
And then the police chief is the highest official for the police department. So those are the primary divisions. There's also parks and rec, buildings and grounds. So they're administered at the parks and keeping all the lawns maintained.
If you go back a generation, 30, 40 years, Butler Township has really exploded, hasn't it?
Sure has.
In terms of, I'm not sure about the population, but in terms of business, wow. I can remember as a little kid, the only thing that was out on Newcastle Road was Montgomery Ward. The new Montgomery Ward store.
There you go. Yeah.
And of course, that's not there anymore. But for people who are new to the Butler area, or people who are not of a certain age, it's almost impossible to believe what Newcastle Road looked like when Montgomery Ward decided to move from the downtown area out there. And other than the VA hospital, that was pretty much it along that stretch.
Yeah.
Who would have believed it now, huh?
Yeah. Really been fortunate with the commercial development. And actually, we've gone from commercial development to now we're basically in the process of redevelopment, taking the old Montgomery Wards down, turn it into what Butler Commons is today.
Yeah. It continues.
Sure.
The development. I don't know how much more space there is out there in that particular area. I must be honest with you. When they started the complex there where the Dick's Sporting Goods and the Starbucks is, I didn't realize they'd even be able to put any business in there because when you looked at the land, you know, before they cut down all the trees and so on, it didn't look like it could work, but son of a gun, they made it work.
Yep, some pretty creative developers out there.
And, of course, there's a couple of new and sizable hotels out there within the past 5 years.
Sure.
The Holiday Inn Express and is it Hampton? Is
Hampton.
That the other one?
Mm-hmm.
Hampton.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The Walmart Supercenter. Actually, Walmart originally was over where Sam's Club is.
Correct.
And they moved, made it a supercenter over to Butler Crossing. Tremendous expansion of retail business in Butler Township. And that, of course, has been great for the income, the tax coffers, because that all brings in a lot of money.
It does. I think it speaks to success of the township. You know, it's a desirable place for commercial endeavors to want to be. Mm-hmm. You know, they want to be there to service our residents and even peripheral residents. So there's a good blend of exchange with the finances in general. You do have a tax base. Awful luxuries to have, you know, a growing tax base when you can.
Mm-hmm.
But the desire for wanting to be there, that's really what's driving continued commercial success.
Tom Knights is the Butler Township manager. Recently appointed to that job earlier this summer. I wanted to ask you about something that always struck me. I can remember I used to cover the Butler Township Commissioners' meetings on a regular basis. I've not been on that beat for a while now since I've been doing this program, but I was always impressed by how much time the Township Commissioners spent on stormwater management, and it kind of goes hand in hand with all of that business development that we were talking about on Newcastle Road. And if you think about it, folks, Newcastle Road is kind of the top of a ridge. You know, I mean, sure. You get on one side, you're going to a deep valley, and you get on the other side, you're going to a deep valley. And when you start laying down all those asphalt parking lots along the top of a ridge, you got water going crazy whenever you get downpours. And Butler Township Commissioners always seemed very conscientious in making sure that any new development had a realistic plan to deal with stormwater.
Yeah, and I think that continues. One of the things that, if you drive around the entire perimeter of the township, you're going to find a lot of the housing plans are still open ditch communities,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you get large driving rains and ditches are inundated with water, old infrastructure. You know, we spend a considerable amount of time and money annually replacing stormwater, and almost seems like you're never going to get caught up. But when you look at the impact of new development, you don't want to make a bad situation worse. So spending that time, having a independent township engineer review all those plans, make sure all the stormwater safeguards are in place. We're not addressing what's downstream. Yeah, mm-hmm. I understand that. But the whole idea is to make sure that what's new doesn't make that worse. Mm-hmm. And I think the township commissioners are all unified in making sure that that doesn't get overlooked. That's a critical component of development.
One final note, and then we want to recap the Sexsmark Festival of the Arts. Preston Park, what an addition.
Yes.
Thanks to the bequest of the late Jane Preston, who was the widow of Dr. Frank Preston. That's one of the more sizable bequests that I've come across here locally.
Sure.
Prior to her death, she willed that that land would become a park and would have to stay a park.
Correct.
Under her will, but it's a tremendous addition of green space to Butler Township.
Sure is. And its uses continue to grow.
Yes, and it will.
Sure.
Over time.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's the key. You know, you're given a park, you're given a parcel of land to create into a park. Surely doesn't happen overnight. You address your needs as you grow. Growing pains, mm-hmm. probably one of the better ways to describe it. But we've got a real good core of dedicated volunteers that help maintain the park, keep the walking trails clear and free. A lot of support from the Week of Caring. We get several organizations that mm-hmm. Want to send folks out there to do whatever's needed to continue to foster the park. So very thankful for that.
I'll be coming up again before too much longer here.
First week of October.
Week of Caring, yeah. A quick break to check midday lottery numbers, and we'll be back to wrap up the information about the Saxonburg Festival of the Arts coming up this weekend. We will be right back.
Midday lottery numbers for you today. The pick 2 is 6565. The pick 3 is 979. The pick 4 is 3221, 3221. The pick 5 is 13885. The wild ball for each of those is 3. The treasure hunt is 5, 14, 18, 22, and 23. Estimated jackpot for tomorrow's treasure hunt is $45,000.
Welcome back. Tom Knight's with us here. Tom has been a volunteer. He's been involved with the Saxsburg Festival of the Arts for a while. The 33rd edition is coming up this weekend. For folks who joined us midstream, Tom, let's just go over the nuts and bolts. First of all, 2 days this weekend, right?
That's right, both Saturday and Sunday. Mm-hmm. Saturday from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. and Sunday from noon to 5.
And the Saxsburg Festival of the Arts will take place not only along Main Street, but in Roebling Park and at Cooper Hall, which is just off Main Street. I think most of our listeners will be somewhat familiar with the layout of Saxsburg. There's no admission charge.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. There will be items for sale, of course, but
plenty for sale.
No charge to get in. There'll be the opportunity to grab a sandwich or a drink.
I would say you could find just about anything that your palate desires out there from one end of town, from the other somewhere. Yeah.
Parking, you can park either at Nock High School or at the Saxonburg Carnival Grounds on Horn Avenue, and there will be shuttles from both of those parking locations. So that's good news for folks who might be wondering about that. And it's a wonderful festival. It really is. I've been down there many, many times. You get a chance to look at some local artists and artisans and photography and a lot of other stuff, too. The museum will be open down at Roebling Park for local history buffs. It's just a fun weekend.
Sure is. Yeah. Yes, it is.
Take the family. Saxonburg Festival.